Good morning. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very happy to welcome you. This is the third day of our conference dealing with bonds, guilt, and other obligations. Now, let me maybe briefly tell you a bit about the artwork or the installations you see here. Rudi Weller and Peter Beyer are the artists. Now, the series you will see today come from different countries. Norbert Adner is the photographer who has made the pictures, and that's what I wanted to tell you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome this afternoon Elena Esposito. She's a sociologist from Italy, a writer. She is a lecturer at the University of Modena in Reggio Emilia. She also studied philosophy with Umberto Eco, studied sociology at the University of Bielefeld. And she wrote her doctor's thesis with Niklas Luhmann, and she has been teaching at the University of Modena in Reggio Emilia, and she's focused on the media and on money. She has written about social forgetting, the paradoxy of fashion, the fiction of the probable reality, and this has been especially important for us, about the future of futures, the time of money in the world of finance. This was published in 2009 in Italian language and in 2010 in German. Now, you certainly remember Michael Hutter, an economist, and politologist at the WZB. He is also carrying out research in the field of innovation, and he will talk with Elena Esposito after her talk. Now, the floor is yours, dear Elena.
Ja, guten Tag, vielen Dank.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for your kind words of introduction. I'm very happy to be here, and I have to say, this is a wonderful place to be. Now, there are two topics I want to talk about: debt and guilt. And the two topics have often been connected in the discussion about money. Now, the question is money good or bad? Does it stem from the devil, or is it about positive forces of society which liquefy and dynamize? And the question is even more important and more urgent and radical when it comes to finance. In particular, this has been the case in the last few years. Now, do we need an ethics of speculation, i.e. an ethics of the circulation of debt? And what does it mean to do the right thing when people only focus on profit? Now, who are the bad guys? Who are the good guys? I mean, is it finance that is bad or evil, or is it the speculator? What is good? What is bad in all of it? Now, one of the merits of our debate is that we have come back to the historical and conceptual roots of the concepts involved. Now, David Graeber has written an important book telling us that first there is money, then there is debt. Which is to say that debts are older and more fundamental. This is what anthropologists and sociologists have long known, and it's plausible. Reciprocity, i.e. a system of the circulation of goods and debts, has for long been an important subject matter and bonding element in society. Debts which have to be repaid established an obligation which connects or links human beings and groups over time. And this makes me think of Malinowski, Mauss, and Polanyi. Now, they are a bond in the truest sense of the word. They are a bond in the form of a temporarily projected mutual dependence of giving and getting. I, who owes something to you, build my future with respect of the process of repaying my debt. Now, debt, thus, is being manifested in the form of a bond, and it does not imply a component of guilt. Now, in the descriptions of the anthropologists, it even has a positive function. It's required by societies which do not rely on writing and which need alternative forms of remote coordination in space and in time. By introducing money, the situation does not change. The structure of the bonds in society has long remained unchanged, which also refers to the positive meaning of debt and of bonding. Aristotle described the world of antiquity, and he described the primary sector of society and of politics, which was well coordinated with the ethics. Politics, i.e. the dimension of the bonds between human beings, defines the good quality of social and societal life, and thus had to correspond to a world order which existed irrespective of the decisions and activities of humankind. The good order, the good system, was a given, a natural system. And it was the duty of men to reflect it in its forms and institutions. Now, the economy was made subject to politics and ethics. Its mission was the maintenance of the natural order in the oikos, in the house, was the symmetry and confirmation of the stability in the relationships with the slaves, the spouses, the children. And when trying to obtain resources, men had to follow nature. So there was farming, there was hunting, there was fishing, and there was barter trade. At the same time, there was a different version of money, a bad one, or at least a morally doubtful, which was part of the category of crematistics, or the art of profit or winning, and which introduced bizarre deviations from nature and the societal order or the system of society, because money becomes a credit loan. And a loan is not about having circulate efficient goods of nature and existing wealth, but to generate more wealth with an origin unknown. So this is not part of the natural order, the system of nature, and is thus taken from an evil source. Later, people said it's given by the devil. Now, this is an irresponsible distortion of nature and of its balance, which has to be criticized. Now, this is the reason why people feared and rejected debts. And this is how debts or the debt acquired its meaning in the context of sin and guilt. At the same time, credit was also about stealing and arbitrariness, as Le Goff showed for the Middle Ages, taking too much money when asking for an interest payment was worse than stealing, than committing a theft, because a theft does not change the world as such, but only its balance. God gave the world to us free of charge, so that we use it. But we should not abuse it. And this is the problem with usury, which is involved as soon as credits are granted and are more or less, and which is more or less the same as a credit. Now, in the course of the 16th and 17th century, the use and the function of money changed fundamentally, and there was a shift towards what we could call crematistics or the bad use of money. Now, the economy is no longer based on agriculture or housekeeping. It's based on trade. Now, money is not only a means of payment in order to buy goods, but becomes increasingly a standard or a measure for the value and the means of the circulation of wealth. Now, modern economy comes into being in those times, and modern economy is a monetarized one. Each good, which has a purpose, which is useful, has a monetary value as well, and this is being expressed in an amount of money. It's the value of exchange. Now, what does it mean? Each object is a good which serves a purpose, but at the same time, it's also a good that has a price. Now, it has a double identity. It's a concrete good, and it's also part of the overall capital, no matter whether you can buy it or not. Also, an object which we don't want to sell for effective or other reasons has a commercial value, and that's what we know. Now, this seems to be a technical step, but it changes fundamentally the relationship with the world and makes it much more abstract. Seen from the perspective of the price, the object loses its concrete nature and its individual characteristics and becomes what all other objects are. So if you express it in the sum, in the terms of money, you can exchange it for any other, even if you don't want to swap it. So this is not about the specific qualities, but about the abstract quantities of its monetary value.
Today, everything has a price, although not everything can be bought. So, is money guilty? And is this really guilt? The genuine scandal of the modern monetarized society, and there is, of course, a scandal, and this is being discussed, but I think the scandal is not the marketing of goods, because in earlier societies it was possible to buy much more. You could buy salvation, you could buy state offices, titles of nobility, women or friends, and they are not for sale any longer today, or should not be for sale. I speak as an Italian, they should not be for sale. The actual scandal is to leave the specific order of the world and the transition to a more abstract and fungible level where everything can be replaced by everything else. To say it technically, this is a transition to a contingent world in which a good or an object are not simply what they are, but can be compared to all others and can be different. Or, to put it more radically, the transition to a society which is no longer geared towards the order of the world and the relationships between individuals in policy and ethics, as was the case with Aristotle, but now first of all turns to the future, that is, the openness and vagueness of temporal relations which are symbolized by money. And this is what it is all about, actually. Monetarization, which we've experienced for 100 years, is brutal, but not because it erases the otherness of goods. This remains or even increases. We know very well what we want to buy or do not want to buy, even if two things have the same price. The differences are increasing. And there's no longer the otherness of objects only, but also the otherness of prices, thus. There is a uniformity, but the uniformity of the objects does not concern the world, but the time, which is a true horizon and reference to the monetarized economy. Because it is in reference with the future that the differences are erased. A sum of money, if it stems from a donation, or that is something positive, or from a fraud, which is something evil. So this money symbolizes the vagueness of future goods and requirements, which are still unknown, which cannot be known, and which are not differentiated. It is about the future. The future is the great problem of modern society, an uncertain and unknown future that is threatening and disturbing. According to the opinion of many authors, starting with Keynes, the function of money shall be localized here. That is, the function of money as a reaction to this threat. And this, they say, is the reason for its vital role in modern society. A sum of money, to say it with a word of Keynes, is a link between the presence and an insidious and threatening future, because it offers a guarantee for its indeterminateness without needing to know it. Future can be open and obscure, and even must remain obscure in modern society. But the presence has a protection due to money. I don't know what will happen, and I don't know what I'm going to need. So this is unknown. But if I do have money, I know that I will be able to meet my requirements and needs, especially because they remain unsafe. If I do have money, I will be able to buy what I need. I even know it now and today, although I do not know what it will be. To say it with Shackle, who's a pupil of Keynes, and he refers to Keynes, he says, the main function of money is to be a medium of deferment and of choice and serve as such. So money enables us to use the passing of time so as to gain information and define our decisions by using the openness of the future as a resource and no longer as a threat. The vagueness of money, which as such is not a good and does not serve as anything, because money actually is useless, it is just paper. This corresponds to the vagueness of a future which does not exist, and nobody knows, not even God knows it, because it depends on what we do today or do not do today. The future is the more unpredictable, the more we try to prepare it. And this is the underlying insecurity of modern society, which above all relates to the circularity of a future which depends on us. And this is why it is more unpredictable and more undetermined compared to the closed future of antique societies, which were determined by fate or by the gods. In old times, people could not know the future. The people were never able to know the future, but not because it was unknowable in the antique times, but because the capacities of humans were limited compared to those of God, because gods were omniscient and omnitemporal, and for gods, the future was not a secret. God was able to know what would happen tomorrow, although humans were not able to do it. But today, things have changed. The future of modern society is radically unknowable to God as well, because it depends on what the people do to us prepare it. And you cannot even assume that this future has a direction or a rationality. The actions of humans which build this future are not always rational and don't act with awareness all the time. And even if they were, they would not always achieve their objects. Our future is thus threatening, or, as we say today, it takes the shape of risk. This is why the modern society is a risk society, as we repeatedly say today, or the society of open future, or the society of money. It's about temporal. It's about temporal problems. Money is thus time, in the sense that its owners have a certain availability of the future. Money symbolizes the opening of future possibilities which do not exist yet but will exist. Credit, this is our topic, credit, which buys and sells money, buys and sells future and buys and sells an openness of possibilities. Those who work with credit use their future in the present and thus influence what they can and or cannot do tomorrow. They open the future or limit the future according to the success of their investments. And we've heard about this these days. There's a circularity in credit, which is known. Those having access to credit get the capacity to do things today which would otherwise not be possible. That is to buy a house, to start a company without capital. But thanks to credit, you get the capital because this person uses the future money in the present. He thus uses the money of tomorrow that he will get in the future. And this circularity can be very productive, but it can also fail. But if the investment is successful, the person will have more money in the future as he would have had. He will thus have more open possibilities. He will be able to pay back the credit and be able to do even more. But if the investment is a failure, and this happens as well, his future will be limited by the necessity of paying back the credit. That means he will not have the possibility to decide in the future. He will thus have less possibilities in the future, and thus he will have less future. The credit risk is the risk of opening and or closing of the future and its options. Back to our topic. What is guilty in all this? What is the guilt? Where is it to be found? Where is the guilt of debts to be found? It is no longer about stealing the future away from God, because our uncertain and undetermined future is not owned by God any longer. It is rather about creating bonds. And this is our topic, bonds. Interventions into the future of which you assume the responsibility. And this is the risk of debt, because it can go smoothly or badly, and there are always both possibilities. But in any case, the future that you will have in the future depends on today's decisions. The sense of indebtedness and its bonding capacity depends on the future and the risk. And this also harkens back to the guilt component of modern credit, which is now ascribed to the debtor and no longer the creditor, as in the antique world. This component comes to the fore due to the crisis. We thus discuss the sense and the form of financialization of the economy, that is, the meaning of credit and the incredible expansion of the circulation of bonds in the so-called irrational euphoria of the markets, that is, the financial markets, since the 1990s. What was called the good finance on the basis of optimism of these decades has changed and has become the main accused of all problems of today's critical phase. The bad, so-called evil, irresponsible greed and blind finance against which people protested in the past years. So finance is guilty, but guilty of what? First of all, it is guilty of having changed the moral sense of debt due to the assessment and management of risk. Until a few decades ago, it was not good to incur debts. We've seen this. Debtors are guilty, and indebtedness had an implicit component of guilt because it was against prudencia, against caution. For many centuries, people thought that caution consisted in the fact in avoiding risk. Those who decided to take a risk, they also had to assume the moral responsibility, and they deviated from safety in the hope of a gain, which could also not be realized. And in this case, he could not rely on the solidarity of the others and not even of himself. This debtor was guilty himself. He took a risk and he thus has to assume responsibility. But there was a major turning point several decades ago. In the 1970s, we had several new finance products. And there's a change in the assessment of risk disposition. And here I'm referring to the 1970s. Since then, the financing tools such as CAPM, Value at Risk, and many others have spread since the 1970s. And they promise to administer, manage, and control risk, and thus neutralize the damage for clever traders. There are the presumed risk-neutral markets of the structured financial products, and the moral perspective radically changes in these markets. There are the traders. To them, insecurity is no longer a threat because they will always fall back on their feet. And in such a case, it is more cautious and praiseworthy to risk instead of maintaining acquired wealth, or even, one can say, those who do not risk are ungenerous towards themselves and others, because the availability of wealth is not increased by himself. So those who do not incur debts are then guilty. Caution is highly risky because it means to give up future gains. But how does this promise work? How can these models neutralize risks, as they claim to do? As long as this point is not clear, it is not clear either if this argument holds water and where there are the errors, because we know that there are, of course, errors. And this makes us move back to our topic, bonds. Bonds, which are the means of managing and dealing with debts, which are the basis for finance, they exponentially spread in the past decades in the forms of obligations or bonds, such as the notorious ABS, which are asset-backed securities, or CDOs, collateral debt obligations, securitization, and above all, the esoteric forms of dizzying trade with derivatives. The finance models of risk management, above all, use these tools, that is, bonds, that is the secondary form of manipulation, and the combination of debt and the insecurity of debt. The incredible number of financial transactions, we know it's up to 10 times the value of the entire global GDP, do not refer to available goods. They would be sufficient to pay them. There would not be sufficient to pay them back because there are not enough goods so as to pay back these sums. So what do they refer to? They rather refer to the object traded and dealt by and through the bonds, which is not a material good, but is risk and management, or more explicitly, to the openness of the future. What bonds sell and buy and bind is the openness of future and the wealth of its possibilities. It depends on the success of the transaction, how much and what future the trader and society as a whole will have, what possibilities are open or closed in the form of circulating money. That is the money that is being used in the present so as to build the future that you want to design. The models of finance work with debts. They thus manage the future and the contingency of future. But how does this management work? How can models be linked to a future which, by definition, does not even exist? That is a future that is indeterminable and even more insecure. Everything that we know about the future is that we do not know it and that it can take many different directions. This is insecurity, of course. The models of structured finance do know that very well, and they do not claim, this would be incredible, they do not claim to predict what will happen. Nevertheless, they offer a guarantee, but this does not make this necessary. It does not make it necessary for them to predict the future. They rather use the impressive numeracy of computers, which cannot predict anything, but are able to manage and deal with complex models. In processing the models, future is not anticipated, but modeled. And as a matter of fact, many alternative futures are modeled. We call these scenarios, that is, ideas that are feasible due to the many data and variables. The model does not determine which future will realize, and it seemingly maintains the openness of the future, but it works with all these futures and with their mutual relationships. The model privileges not an expected or desired future, but it models all the futures. The claim of financial models is to consider all possible paths and to prepare a strategy for all of them. This happens on the basis of diversification and compensation, coverage and arbitration, most of the time by using derivatives and other tools which make it possible to use financial leverage so as to operate with lower or even without any costs. This is why you can develop that many scenarios. But if the model is to provide a protection for all possible future developments, then it is not necessary to know the future so as to be on the safe side. The models are used by the trader. The traders don't need to be concerned about future risks any longer. There's an interpretation of structured finance. In it, risks are not being erased because you know that you cannot predict the future. One does not talk about risk-free market. One knows exactly that there are risks. One speaks about risk-neutral markets. The risks remain, but they are no longer a threat because they no longer cause any damage for the people who have used the models. The attitude vis-à-vis debt and speculation is just a consequence of this. If the risk is no longer risky, the one who does not risk risks more because he loses out on a possible gain and because it does not contribute to preparing the future of all in a generous manner. The debt and guilt should be attributed in a more dynamic way, which is compatible with the new flexibility of markets and their management. Is that true? Is that correct? Today, several years after the bubble burst and after the spreading of the crisis, it has become obvious that this is not the case and that the spreading of the financial models and the structured finance tools have increased the extension and the drama of the risks. It is less obvious why this happened and where the error is to be found. Or it is not clear either where guilt is to be found. In this bewilderment of the crisis, one obsessively tried to find the guilty, and usually you found them in unscrupulous speculants and sorcerer apprentices who used the means that they have not controlled without taking care of the consequences. This happened in a blind gear of finance, which was decoupled from production and the world and is entangled in a self-referential operation. All this is true, of course, but the idea is that the result of this dynamic is stealing the future at the cost, at the expense of the younger generation, which has to deal with bonds which were produced by the past and to which the younger generation has not made a contribution, but they have to deal with it, especially in the form of bonds. The excessive utilization of future during the years of financial euphoria resulted in a presence without future for the young people today, and they are protesting, of course. Guilty are those who did not take care of this at the right moment in time. There are many reasons for this description. But this is a too simple explanation for other reasons. First of all, because the future is always bound. It is not possible otherwise, because the future is not pre-given, but is actively designed by the present and by decisions. The future always depends on the present, because otherwise there would not be a future. It thus depends on the present that it prepares, also if it is a surprise. And then it is not true that the presents of the young people today do not have a future. The future always exists, but in this case, the presence has less means to manage and align it. So in this meaning of the description, there is less future because there are less open possibilities. And this, as it were, is the guilt of the finance, that is, the finances to blame. But is it an individual guilt of the speculants or some speculants? To see it individually, speculants can be exemplary role models. Let us think about the philanthropic activities of Warren Buffett and George Soros only. Nothing to say against it, on the contrary. And it is also difficult to accuse greed in the markets, because in the markets you're always acting and thereby looking for profit. If you want to find guilt, you should try to search it in the changing of the sense of guilt in risk management and the openness of the future, because machines and models can produce astonishing volumes and quantities of data, and they can design scenarios for many alternative futures, but they cannot consider the only future that will then actually occur, because they are not able to neutralize the circularity of the relationship between the present and the future. The fact that the future does not only depend on the present, but depends on a present which is geared towards the future and tries to predict it so as to determine the own behavior. The future depends on a present which is aligned to the future. The future in whose past there are models which try to neutralize it. This is really complicated, but this is the way it happens. The sense of the open future is not really the number of available possibilities, as was pre-required by the models, but there is a circularity which results in an element of undeterminedness, of insecurity, which cannot be taken into consideration by the models. Guilt, if you want to find it, is not to be found in greed and the lack of responsibility, because the models operate against it. They are obsessive considering the vagueness of future, but it is rather to be found in a lack of attention for circularity and its consequences. As in many other cases, guilt is to be found in the lack of self-referential awareness and in the claim to observe the world as if you were outside it. So in this case, you find the error in simplification, which does not reflect itself. And if you really want to maintain an ethical principle, you should take into consideration the ethical imperative, according to Heinz von Förster. Quote, to act always so as to increase the number of decisions, unquote. Also and especially if this contradicts the current orientation. However, need to make a last step, and this will be my conclusion. By this, I would like to address the main question in the quest of the guilty and the ones to blame. If you raise the question like this, you should also take into account von Förster's principle, and you should apply it to yourself and to your own behavior, and you should ask what the consequences of the quest of guilt are. If you're looking for the ones to blame, for the guilty ones, you turn to some problems, you do not turn to other problems. For example, the blindness of the guilty and the causes are not being taken into consideration. You encourage conflicts and controversies, and you're geared towards the past and resentments instead of the design of the future, which remains uncertain. And ye less future is being built in the present, the smaller there's an open opportunity for a future. So the quest for the guilty and guilt is definitely legitimate. There are many reasons to it, but this quest should be applied to oneself. You could put it differently. Who takes the assumes the responsibility for the damages of this quest? And who needs to be blamed for this searching for the guilty, for the ones to be blamed? Thank you very much.